here we are, 1 year later. When we went into our first lockdown, it was almost refreshing. No cars on the road, our neighbors out walking around the block, many with a smile on their faces and a nod or hello. I felt like we were having a surprise mini vacation. For our small businesses, many saw this as a temporary quick hit that might be difficult to get through, but was a necessary evil in order for us as a society to come out better on the other side. Most of us have friends whose businesses didn't make it. This is our normal now. Over a year later, close to 3 million deaths around the world, and our mental health in a crisis that it's never seen before. This is the first time I have ever known where mental health is being talked about so out in the open. The known number prior to the pandemic was 1 in 5. On a typical day, 1 in 5 people in our country and around the world suffered from a mental health issue. Today, 2 in 5, 3 in 5. Our frontline workers, our healthcare providers, emergency room doctors and nurses, those that have been at the forefront of dealing with this are under a strain that has been so significant that we've seen many suicides. We expect those people to do their jobs without emotion or impact or consequences to their well-being. We don't truly understand what they're actually going through. Today, we're talking with Brenna Goldie. She is one of our frontline workers that has had direct experience in dealing with this pandemic and the impact of it on herself and those around her. Hi, Brenna. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I really do appreciate your time. So let's talk a little bit about where you've come from and how you've ended up in the position you're in, because you're not a practicing nurse directly. You're in administration now, but you have practical experience across numerous departments within the hospital. So you decided to become a nurse, which is commendable, because it's I can't imagine the kinds of things that you end up going through as a nurse. So let's talk a little bit about that. Why a nurse?
I had very personal reasons for deciding to be a nurse, and they were actually very related to mental health. My brother actually struggled with mental health. It was in the hospital, a couple different hospitals. And I wasn't entirely happy with his care, to be honest. And I thought I wanted to do better and I wanted to be better. So I went into nursing school. Funny enough, I actually didn't even do mental health nursing until just the very tag end of my hospital career. And getting into nursing has made me realize that I can't do better. These people are doing the absolute best that they can with the resources that they're given. And that's kind of why I'm kind of leading into more of an administrative role, because I feel that the level of change that I'm wanting to make that has inspired me to go into nursing, I wasn't getting the return back from nursing. I think I need to move up in terms of policy development and affecting actual change.
You've spent time in the emergency room.
I have. Yeah. So I was, I've been in an emergency department for about a year, and it's just been the entirety of the lockdowns we've had. Right when it was declared a national pandemic, I had been in the emergency department for maybe a month or so. So my entire time in the emergency department was the life of the pandemic.
I know from my own experience of going to emergency rooms, just like everybody else across the province and probably across the country, typically you walk into an emergency room, you look around and you see all the people that are there and you think, oh man, how long is this going to take? And often we're seeing 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, depending on what's happening for you. So one of the things that we've come to the realization is that a lot of the little things that we used to rush off to the hospital or to the doctor for, we can wait. We can take care of that ourselves. So there's a good thing. The bad thing is the people that are walking into the emerge for the most part are people that are probably affected by COVID. And that strain on you and the system and the way that it was running must have been tremendous. So let's talk about the emergency room. Let's talk about when things started happening, where people were actually coming in and they're demonstrating COVID-19 symptoms.
So everything's just taking so much more time than it had before. So that was definitely challenging. And it's just been a wild ride, to be honest. I think the beginning was very scary because, you know, they called a state of emergency. We watched them take away our collective agreements. We were told that we could get moved to other hospitals anywhere in the province or even in the country if they need help with that. Trent opened up houses that if you were working at the hospital, you could go and live at Trent so that you're not risking infecting your family, which is very scary. And then on top of that, we're human too. So all of those frustrations that you have with the pandemic, as a small business owner, as like a service worker, we have those as well. It's frustrating not seeing our families and our friends. It's sad not being able to go out and about and do shopping and things like that. So it was just it was scary at first. And then I know you had said that it felt like a bit like a vacation when it very first started. That just wasn't the case for healthcare workers because we were still working. We were asked to work more. And then all of these changes were coming around us. And then the fear of the unknown was really, really bad back then. I think at this point, we have a little bit of a grip on what is to come. And we have a little bit more insight to the virus, but with these mutations and the variants and that, it's heading right back into this scary territory where it's just the fear of the unknown again. It's everything that we dealt with, but jacked up a notch. So it's definitely scary, and it definitely does take a big toll on mental health.
We as patients and people that don't work in that kind of a career, we don't think about the kind of stresses and strains that a healthcare worker would be under, especially working in an emergency department. The expectation when we go in there is you're there to do your job. I'm there to have you do your job. And I'm not thinking about how you feel. And I know from experience of seeing and hearing, sometimes patients can get abusive and rude. And I know that there's zero tolerance for that, but there's a level of tolerance of that up to the point where it becomes intolerable and somebody needs to be removed. So there is this level of abuse or level of a comprehension challenge, we'll call it, that people just don't seem to recognize how hard a job it is for you to do. So even outside of the emergency department, you were still under those kinds of stresses and strains. So what does that look like?
As for mental health beforehand, I'm going to be honest, it's definitely worse since the pandemic because there are those, I think just the social isolation and all, again, all of those things that you are feeling, we are feeling as well. But to be honest, we've been yelling for years that we need more staff, that we need better equipment, that, it's so frustrating. I think one of the things that would help us huge is having more community supports. I don't know if people know this, but I got a $13 an hour pay jump when I went to the hospital from leaving my community job, that's significant. So they have a really hard time keeping people in community nursing, but that is something that would enable people to stay at home so they don't have to come into the hospital. They don't have to come when they have questions. They don't have to come when they have smaller concerns because community care can keep people in their homes for much longer. A big stressor on the hospital is our ALC patients, which is our alternate level of care patients. And most of them are waiting for long-term care homes. And long-term care homes are very saturated right now. It's very hard to get a bed in these long-term care homes. So they stay in the hospital for extended periods of time because there's nowhere for them to go. There's not enough community resources to help them. So they stay in the hospital. Their care needs are high. It is very, very exhausting. And our staffing just keeps getting cut again and again and again. I know I have some friends in a unit that I just used to work, and they are cutting another nurse coming up, and they think like they don't know how they're going to manage because they feel like they're barely managing now. So as much as the pandemic has definitely affected our mental health in terms of our outside life, and all the extra policies and the time-consuming policies that have developed within the hospital, it's just also exhausting because you think, we've been telling you this for so long. We've been asking for supports. We've been asking for help, and we get the opposite in a lot of these situations. So the pandemic, as much as it's had a negative toll, I can't say that it wasn't foreseeable, really.
Thank you. I cannot thank you enough. And I really want you to take it to heart to not diminish the experiences, because one of the things that I've learned in my mental health journey over the last, specifically in the last year, we do that. We will often just diminish our own challenges because we'll look and see someone else that has it harder than we do. We need to address ours so we're strong enough that we can help them, because they're the ones that really need us to step up. They're the ones that need you in administration, recognizing where all of the hard spots are that need to be fixed. We need leadership. We need people in government. We need people in the private sector all working together to make sure that we as a society are doing the right things so that we can come out on the other side of this. And whatever comes next, because there is a next, there's a really big next around the corner that we need to make sure that we're prepared for, and that people understand and people recognize how hard it is, a job that you've done. So thank you. I really, truly appreciate the work that you've done. Thanks.
Thank you. That means a lot. It really does.
In carrying on the conversation about healthcare and healthcare workers, we're now going to be speaking with Dane Bland. Dane has a background working in the healthcare industry and is currently seeking the nomination for the Liberal seat for our member of provincial parliament for Peterborough and the Kawarthas. And I'm going to let Dane walk through some of his qualifications, because he will definitely be able to do it better than I. So thank you for coming on, Dane. I appreciate you giving me the time to do this. And let's walk through a little bit of the history of your personal history in work and where you're at now and where we're going to be going in the future, or looking to go in the future.
Hi there. No, thanks for having me, Chris. I really appreciate being here. As you mentioned, I am seeking the provincial Liberal nomination in Peterborough, Kawartha for the 2022 provincial election. And look, before we get going, I want to direct people to my website, which is danebland.ca. That's danebland.ca. To learn a little bit more about my background, I'll introduce myself in a second, but to learn a little bit more about my background, where I stand on issues and concerns, and the philosophy that I really bring to this race, which is to elevate local issues in Peterborough, Kawartha to the provincial table, and to be an issues-driven and ideas-focused candidate that actually puts real critical thinking back into our politics. So look, we're going to have a really great conversation this afternoon, but as we talk more, I would really encourage and be flattered if people went to my website to learn a little bit more about me. And if you like what you hear over the course of this conversation, please, please feel free to sign up and support me as I seek this nomination. It takes just 30 seconds and it's absolutely free. I'd be really honored to have your support. And it would be wonderful to have you join as part of our movement. Thank you for also interviewing Brenna, the nurse that you spoke with before me. I think it's important that we hear from folks like her about what's going on the front lines. And I took a lot of inspiration from Brenna's story. Let me introduce a little bit about myself. As you said, I am seeking the provincial Liberal nomination in Peterborough, Kawartha. That's not something that I'm taking lightly, and I'm excited to be doing that. I am taking this next step in representing the community because I've spent the last 12 years working in the nonprofit sector across various industries. As you mentioned, healthcare being my most recent adventure, working in community management, relationship building, and advocacy for a series of hospitals. I've also worked in the past in education, post-secondary education specifically, in the arts, culture, and heritage sectors across numerous different organizations. And you could rail off a bunch in Peterborough, Kawartha. I've probably worked with them. And as well, my most recent position that I accepted, I'm actually just ending my very first week as the director of philanthropy with an organization called Rainbow Railroad, which is an LGBTQI organization that does work around the world helping LGBTQ folks escape state-sponsored persecution. So I'm very excited about that new adventure. But as you did say, yes, I've spent the last few years working in healthcare. And so, you know, I see what Brenna's talking about. I see it firsthand all the time.
So one of the things that we were talking about was mental health prior to pandemic and how things have shifted and changed and what the differences are. And in my introduction, I talked about the strain on the system and the strain on the people. And we know historically that when the government is involved in healthcare, they're making decisions based on dollars as opposed to people. And from my own experiences with mental health and having my own mental health issues and going through the system, I'm one of the fortunate ones. I think I'm incredibly lucky. I was able to advocate for myself. I wasn't in a financial position where I was destitute or didn't even have an address that I could call on. I was able to work my way through the healthcare system to the point where I have a therapist and a psychiatrist with regular appointments, and I have medication that I can get on a consistent basis. But I'm lucky. I'm one of the very, very lucky people that has that. Most people, when they start entering into the mental health care system, it's a massive struggle that they really, really have challenge and difficulty with. So let's start there. Let's start with What do you see as being the challenges that we have today?
Well, look, today looks very different than, you know, we're sitting here in April. Today looks very different than 13 months ago. But even 13 months ago, this was a massive problem. And you mentioned the provincial government looking at this as a dollar and cents issue. The Ford government cut $335 million of proposed spending in mental health care. And, you know, to me, we can't quantify crises like the mental health crisis we're facing in terms of dollars and cents. It has to be reframed and focused in terms of people. And, you know, thank you for sharing your story. I'm also one of the lucky ones. I get to take a pill a day and it's fine. I've been open about, you know, the fact that I've got anxiety and I've struggled in the past with depression, but I'm very lucky that I can take a pill a day. That pill is paid for by private pharmacare. Which is another issue, and I get to go about my daily life really feeling completely normal, and that's not the case for so many people. And this isn't a $335 million issue. This is a multi-billion dollar issue, and the fact that we're taking any money away from it just completely and wholeheartedly unacceptable. And look, what if I had said to you in January of 2020, if you could spend a little bit of money. When it came to part to the whole, you could spend just a fraction of the money that you spend every year on healthcare. If you spent it right now, we could prevent needless deaths. We could prevent community spread of COVID-19. If I told you that we could do that by spending, you know, $1-3 billion, which sounds like so much money, but if we went back in time and fixed those problems and there was a magic wand that we could all wave, To face this oncoming crisis in a more prepared way, and all it took was a little bit of spending, there is not a single soul on earth who wouldn't rubber stamp, yes, do whatever we need to do to prevent what just happened. And look, we're sitting on the precipice of that exact same kind of crisis in mental health, and we are sitting here going, $335 million is $335 million too much to spend to face down the crisis. I mean, look, you said in your introduction, prior to the pandemic, 1 in 5 Canadians experienced concerns related to mental health. That is, what's my math here? 6 million, 6.5, 7 million people in our country are experiencing some kind of mental health difficulty. And how many more of those are also going undiagnosed or unidentified because they're part of vulnerable communities where they don't have access to the kind of care that they need to even be told by a healthcare practitioner, you're diagnosed with X. And so, I just think about we truly are standing on the precipice of a crisis, and we've heard from healthcare practitioners, we've heard from experts, there are investments that we can make. We're not going to ever prevent that crisis, but there are investments that we can make right now in our system. There are investments in skills and getting more people trained to combat this mental health crisis. There's investments that we can make in our people to equip them to better deal with their own mental health. We can make them now, and maybe it will prevent some deaths, and maybe it will help save some lives, and maybe it will actually prevent a significant amount of healthcare spending down the line because we mitigated it up front. And I just think that there isn't a price tag that you can put on something like that. Because we just know, we know for a fact, you hear it from everybody. There's no political stripes in the fact that people acknowledge we're at a mental health crisis and we're on the precipice of something worse.
I think part of the challenge is when the majority of the populace, and still that is the majority, even though, you know, it's 20% of people are going to suffer some challenge, or 25% of people that are going to suffer a challenge. I think that when it is the majority of the population that isn't directly affected or doesn't understand how they're affected or how it does impact their lives. Because I think that's the biggest challenge, is people don't realize how much it does impact their lives because they just don't see it. And when you can't see it, it's awfully hard to justify spending money on it. When the federal government put some money in last year in advance of challenges that were coming, it was $50 million. They put forward $50 million. That's not enough at all. So we do definitely have to see changes made, and we need to do that by prioritizing how people view it. And I think, as I said in the intro, mental health has never been talked about more ever in my lifetime than it has in the past, I'd say, 6 months. It's really coming to the forefront. There are people that are having anxiety today that have never known what anxiety is before. And I remember quite clearly when I had my first round of anxiety in my 20s, I thought I was having a heart problem. I thought I was having a physical heart problem because I was getting these things going on. And when I finally talked to a doctor about it, they're like, oh, it's anxiety. You know, here's what you can do. And it didn't make sense. I didn't understand it because we don't look at mental health with enough information or comprehension as to what it is. Anyway, and I think I really think that people don't understand, and they don't have the ability to connect the dots, and there are not enough dots to get connected. You know, when you look at somebody who might be homeless, there are people who say, well, that's terrible. That guy obviously made terrible decisions that have ended up leading him to where he is. But It's the trauma that has driven that life that has created the circumstances to which that person has ended up in that terrible place, which might include addiction. And if we start talking about opioid addiction as compartmentalized, it seems to be in its own package that is separate from. But if we start trying to connect these dots, if we start trying to put the story in line so we can see the transition of someone going from having a happy, healthy life to homelessness, it's mental health all along the way. So in looking at opioid addiction, in looking at people that have substance abuse problems, where are we trying to put that together within mental health for all of us to be able to comprehend and help address as an issue?
Let's break that down a little bit. So one of the things that you spoke about first, and I'll start here, is on stigma reduction. Or at least being upfront. And you're right that the majority of Canadians do not themselves experience mental health issues. But if you think of the nuclear family of, you know, two parents and two children, that means that one of those people is probably experiencing a mental health issue. So this is in our house, right? It's not some distant thing that impacts 40,000 people a year. And you probably don't know one of them. You know somebody who is experiencing a mental health issue, whether you're aware of it or not. Right. And if you're not aware of it, it probably means that you're not being an ally to that community because they haven't told you. And so, look, when it comes to this being a significant concern and a significant issue, the fact is that every single person in our country knows someone who is currently experiencing or has experienced a mental health issue. It's mathematically impossible that you do not, unless you interact with zero people a day. So look, that in and of itself should be motivation to tackle this issue. But look, if you want to talk about, we can slice this pie a million different ways. You can slice it the human way, which is someone you know is experiencing a crisis and therefore we need to intervene, or is experiencing an illness and therefore requires treatment. Or we could slice it the economic way, which, look, if you're a business person, if you only care about in and out of dollars and cents, the economic burden of mental health issues in Canada is estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 billion per year. So there is no investment. That's the economic burden, because think about it. There are people who experience mental health difficulties who then don't go to work, so we lose productivity. There is costs to dealing with addiction issues in our community. There's costs to treating drug addiction like a crime and therefore policing it and therefore putting these people into prison. There are costs to being reactive in the way that we're providing care, which is, you know, someone's already overdosed or somebody, you know, has attempted to hurt themselves or has attempted suicide. That is a much more expensive way to deal with the problem than by trying to front end these things and deal with them with a preventative model. And yet somehow we get locked in the fact that, you know, if we spend $50 now, God, $50 seems like a lot of money. We get so focused on the $50 now that we forget that it's $1,000 later.
Right.
And I think that's a big concern of mine. And look, I've shared this with anybody who asks. I'm a huge believer that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so I think when we talk about opioid addiction specifically, that's the approach that I believe in. And that's the approach that I believe in as a person and as someone who's seeking the nomination in Peterborough, Kawartha, a city that's experiencing an opioid epidemic and an opioid crisis related to both a lack of treatment options and treatment availability, a poisoned drug supply, stigma, associated with care, and a lack of mental health, appropriate mental health resources in our community. It's a perfect storm to create this mental health crisis that we're in. And, you know, if it's, don't quote me 100% on this, but I'm pretty sure that more people died of opioid overdose in Peterborough or suspected opioid overdose in Peterborough than COVID-19 in 2020. And if it wasn't exact, it was pretty darn close. And so when we think about, okay, what are we going to do? This is loss of life. What are we going to do to prevent this issue? Look, I'm in favor of pulling out as many stops as we need to fix this as a problem, because it's going to make our entire community better. There are some simple solutions, though. Look, MPP Dave Smith promised PRHC funding for rehab beds. I believe it was 6 or 8 rehab beds, which, by the way, is not enough. But that funding, which was promised, I believe, in January of 2020, or perhaps even the end of 2019, is nowhere to be seen, and PRHC is not equipped with rehab beds for people to actually go to the hospital and go through rehab, you know, withdrawal from opioids in a safe way with specialist care that's funded. So that doesn't exist in our community. We've got a site downtown that is ready and waiting for funding to be prepared to offer wraparound services, community-based services that aren't just addictions treatment or safe injection, but also deal with the other associated sort of spiral off issues that people who are experiencing drug addiction also often experience, you know, discrimination, homelessness, loss of jobs, poverty. This is a wraparound service site that's ready to go in our community. It's programmed. We have a series of nonprofit agencies who are willing to partner on this, and there's just no money there. And if you think about how much money can be saved by reducing the amount of policing that's required in our downtown, by reducing the amount of ambulatory calls where ambulance workers or even, goodness, private citizens are administering naloxone to people who are experiencing opioid overdose, and then they have to go for extended hospital stays to make sure that they're okay. And then they access social safety net programs when they get out. And then it's a vicious cycle because we're doing nothing to prevent that. Think of how much money that costs versus let's get a check in the hands of the people who actually want to do some good in our community to provide wraparound services that actually are going to mitigate some of these issues. It is shown to work. It has been shown to work in communities across our country, whether that's small towns, whether that's small cities like Peterborough, or that's in major cities like Vancouver and Toronto. There have been numerous pilot programs. There are full-time operating programs. There's a significant number of nonprofit organizations doing this work. And every single one of them can say a dollar for us means $10, $20, $50, $100 that the community isn't spending on the other end trying to fight this issue the wrong way.
So that brings up two things to my mind. The first one being, would you be open to the idea of the legalization of all the drugs in such a way as to how maybe Portugal has done it? If you look at the model that they're using there, if you're caught on the street with X amount, which is more than, I think it's 5 days supply. I might be off by a day or two, but anything more than 5 days supply of any drug, you actually have to go in and see a doctor. They send you to a therapist to go talk about why you have that much in drugs. And it's a legalization. So the police are no longer involved. So all the money that was being spent by the police is not being spent. So that's the first part. You know, if you think that the Portugal model is something that we really should seriously look at. And then of course, the secondary piece to that, which is the funding of the way the police system is now, altering that to be more inclusive with social structure, staff that are heading out, so that we're sending the right people to go up to calls where handcuffs aren't needed, but a therapist is. So we're, you know, the Portugal model, and then, you know, the phrase that everybody loves to use is defund the police, but it's not defunding the police. It's the reallocation of funding in such a way as to help better support the police and support the community. So where do you stand on that?
So on the Portugal issue, there's actually talks in the government of Canada right now, in the Federal Liberal Party. There's a few MPs who are pushing Portugal as a model for exploration. I'm thinking of some of the great work that's being done on Task Force, and you're going to have to forgive me because I'm going to forget some of the names, but Nathaniel Erskine-Smith is one of them who cited Portugal as an example numerous times. And there is currently actually Patty Heju, the Minister of Health, I believe, is leading a pilot program in Vancouver on safe supply. How can we better spend money to support our community safety and to support our community in a safe way? And that's the philosophy that I approach this issue, is that we need to seriously re-examine. We don't have community supports or 24/7 community supports that exist for these types of interventative calls that you're proposing, where when someone's experiencing a drug overdose, you call 911 because it's the only resource that we have. And 911 has three options to send you. They can send an ambulance, they can send a police officer, they can send firefighters, and sometimes they send to whichever one can get there first. And look, I just think we need to add another option or another couple of options to that menu. Community service workers, social workers, performing first checks or wellness checks. There's no reason for police to have to go on wellness checks. I'm sure if you ask police officers, they would say, I would love to have a community support worker with me on these calls to help me do my job better. Look, in my day job, if you told me that I could have someone sitting right beside me that would make me better at my job, I'd take that all day, every day. And it's not an insult to me. And police officers that I've spoken with don't find it an insult. Now, they don't want to have their entire organization taken away from them because they care and they think that there's value. And I agree. But I also agree that there are philosophical changes that we can make to the system of policing that help police officers do their job better, and that help the people who are interacting with police officers do so in a much safer way. There's a pilot program, I believe, that's actually being run in Peterborough, where there's a community service worker that tags along with a unit that's specifically designed to approach addictions, homelessness issues, people who are experiencing some kind of a mental health difficulty. And functions as an interventative support system. The other thing I will say to color this is, I also, again, I sit here as a white man who has a full-time job, does not experience addictions issues. I'm very lucky to have shelter. So my interactions with police officers look a lot different than people who experience the world differently than me. There are people of color in our community in Peterborough, Kawartha, who experience difficulty in interacting with police. There are LGBTQI people in our community who experience, trans folks in particular, who experience difficulty when interacting with police, and people who are currently struggling with addiction or with mental health issues or with homelessness have a much more difficult time interacting with police, and those issues intersect. Often there are people from all of those, you know, communities all at once who are having to interact with our police officers. And I also think that we need to do a significant amount of consultation with people who have experienced trauma in dealing with law enforcement to better inform how we can do better in protecting our communities with them represented as members of our community who experience difficulties in interacting with law enforcement. It's an impossibly difficult issue to try and just tackle top down. So as an elected official, look, I could sit there with a prescription pad and work with colleagues to present bills. But I think that that would be a mistake in doing so without proper community consultation, including community consultation with people impacted by these issues.
For those that are having opioid addictions and those that are homeless and those that are suffering from those mental health issues that are outside the normal channels, that also then ends up putting people in a position where our emergency rooms are full and our wait times for healthcare are awful because there's so many people with so many issues that could have been dealt with by a family doctor, mm-hmm. if they'd been on medication, mm-hmm. if they weren't living on the street, if they weren't an addict. So carrying on forward there. So how do we start making those adjustments so that we are reducing the wait times and helping these people get better healthcare?
That's a great question. So I think in many ways, parts of the Peterborough community are getting some of this right. One of the largest practitioners of the kind of family medicine that you're speaking about in the Peterborough community. In fact, I do believe the largest. There's the Peterborough Family Health Team. And one of the things that I've been really inspired about the Ontario Liberal Party is exploring this kind of family health team model and making sure that every Ontarian has access to a team of family medicine practitioners and associated services. I, by the way, I'm a patient of the Peterborough Family Health Team. And if I get referred, if I need X or if I need a scan or if I need a chiropractor, and they even, I believe, have dental care, it's all sort of housed in the within a 3 or 4 block radius in the downtown community. And that's the kind of service, but there are wait lists to access that service. And so I would love to see a more of that kind of a model of care. And I think many doctors would as well, because it makes their lives easier. They know exactly where they're referring patients. They're part of one system. They can see colleagues' wait lists. They know the people that they're recommending patients to because they work with them, their colleagues. And they're specialists within these care teams as well. So I think that's a really great model, and Peterborough has been a pioneer. Peterborough as a community has been a pioneer in that model, and it's now something that I think we need to look at across the entire province. The other thing is we should probably stop canceling $1 billion of funding to our public health units, which prior to the pandemic, the Ford government had proposed amalgamating public health units. Peterborough is one of the ones that was identified for amalgamation, Peterborough Kawartha, and there was going to be an overall cost reduction of $1 billion. And now amalgamation, I can tell you right now, amalgamation is not the way to provide healthcare because of administrative efficiencies. You can't do the work of, the 30 some odd, the 30 some odd public health units in the province with 14 of them. It's just not, while finding administrative efficiencies to save $1 billion. And by the way, there are not $1 billion of administrative efficiencies in our public health system. Make no mistake about it, this was a funding cut. And some of the things that people miss about public health, our public health systems, is they don't just fight pandemics. They also help to fight addictions in our community. And the Peterborough Public Health Team has been really doing as much as they possibly can with the funding allocated to them to try and, make statements around the opioid epidemic, to provide awareness, to encourage folks, like you or me, to learn how to use naloxone kits, and to also, issue warnings when there's been a series of opioid-related either overdoses or deaths in the community, to say there's a problem with our supply at the moment, and making sure that service providers are aware of that so they can inform their clientele that that's an issue. So our public health teams do a lot of lifting here. And then finally, I'm a big believer in taking a look at solutions as a whole versus just as parts. So, we could put funding into interventative therapy, we could put funding into recovery, we could put funding into addictions treatment and look at them as separate things, but they're not, they're all interrelated. And look, this is a perfect example of where I differ from, Mr. Smith in Peterborough, the current MPP, and perhaps even some of my colleagues, is rehab beds are absolutely needed. But Mr. Smith's solution to an opioid epidemic is to provide beds for people when they are detoxing. So it's after they've experienced crisis, now they're in rehab, rather than trying to front end it. So his solution is reactive. It's taking, and it's more costly. Whereas if we took, look, we need those rehab beds in our community. But if you had to pick between rehab beds or preventative medicine, again, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I personally, by the way, don't get me wrong, we need both. But if your solution to the problem is, well, let's put hospital beds in place for when people need them because they're going to experience opioid problems. Just think about how that sounds. That it's acknowledging that this is just a part of the community and a part of our society and a series of issues that we have no control over. Therefore, we need to provide healthcare when people experience it. Right. That seems very helpless to me. When there are things that we can do that help to alleviate the burdens on our healthcare community, we could fund a nurse for every public health unit that specializes in addictions triaging and treatment. And they could help to direct traffic. So rather than people showing up at Emerge experiencing opioid crises or showing up in community programs experiencing opioid crises, they have a place where they can go to have their issues triaged. And yeah, and community nurses do yeoman's duties on this kind of thing, to then be able to be referred to the appropriate partner. Just something that simple, having someone in the middle of it helping to direct a little bit of traffic, could seriously reduce wait times. And of course, as another way to reduce wait times in our province is not to cut $335 million that's earmarked for mental health care. It's to properly and appropriately fund mental health practitioners and their training, starting from post-secondary institutions, putting emphasis on creative programming related to training the next generation of mental health care workers, all the way through to, yeah, rehab beds. But it starts a lot more granular than just that.
It's interesting that you say that. As you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself as well, as far as an ounce of prevention, as I've talked about mental health being part of our overall health as an inclusive system, and starting with children as they're going through their checkups on a regular basis, having mental health be part of that. So you and I have talked about this previously, and I want to dig into it because I think it's a really important issue, and that's youth diagnosis. So the kids that are going well in crisis, that are not getting proper diagnosis, they're not getting proper supports, and they're not getting the help that they need at the young age that they are. I know of kids that have been taken to the hospital, 12, 13 years old, that were talking about self-harm, that were told, you're okay, go home. It's a much bigger issue. And having a child who has some challenges in dealing with some anxiety at home and learning how to cope and deal with that as a parent, it's a lot of work and it's difficult and it needs help too. So the parents need support and information and education, and the kids need the help and the support. How do we start working toward that? And what do we need to fix to help with that diagnosis process?
Yeah, so you put your finger on an important issue, and this is something that I've also seen being bandied about as part of as a consideration in the Ontario Liberal platform. It's something I wholeheartedly believe in, which is that every Ontarian who wants should be able to access mental health first aid training. And again, we talk about prevention. If your child is experiencing mental health crisis, if you had just one more tool in your toolbox to be able to help de-escalate that situation or provide them a care that they need, I don't know a single parent who wouldn't pull that tool out if they had it. And so that's something that I think is critically important that we do right off the bat. I've taken mental health first aid training. I've taken safe talk and suicide awareness training. And I've had suicide assist training as well. And in all of this training, one of the things that it's taught me most significantly is to have a better understanding of these issues and how they interact with our society and how to be empathetic to them. And so I think We also talked earlier in our conversation about stigma reduction. If more Ontarians received mental health first aid training, we might have a better chance of being a stigma-free society, or at least a society that's better equipped to talk about these issues as a whole. So there's one thing. And you identified youth diagnosis. This is something I learned really recently. As I'm seeking this provincial Liberal nomination, one of the things I'm committed to doing is I am 100% committed to learning about issues and being an issues-driven and ideas-focused candidate. And learning about difficulties that young folks experience being diagnosed with mental health concerns because of healthcare system regulations was something that really caught me off guard. It's something I didn't know about. And many people don't know that youth experience difficulty in being diagnosed with specific mental health issues or specific mental health disorders because of their age. When you're talking about healthcare wait times, some of the longest wait times and some of the folks experiencing the most difficulty in accessing care are those between the ages of 14 and 24. So our secondary and post-secondary age population experience a real barriers to access on mental health. And, you know, having worked for a university before, I can tell you right now that there is, you know, the wait list is at least double as long as the treatment list is. And that's just at one specific university. And that has nothing to do with the university. They're trying their best. It's the province that isn't funding it. And the province, by the way, doesn't treat university and post-secondary institution or secondary school-led mental health care as healthcare. It actually does not meet the definition of healthcare in the province, as far as I'm aware. There's a regulatory gap there. Which leads to funding concerns. So look, there's something else as well. That the fact that some of our longest waitlists in our community are among people 14 and 24, maybe we need to seriously consider what we're doing to help prevent those issues in people, you know, as they enter into puberty, 12, 13, 14.
Brenna actually brought it up. It was quite interesting. When she worked in the social community structure, her pay raise when she went to the hospital was $13 an hour. She had increase of $13 an hour. Now, as we are having all of these nurses and doctors and professionals in our healthcare system burning out because public and COVID, those two things together, they're working in the public system for the government-funded system, and they're working on COVID. They're burning out, stressing out, and dropping out. It's an awfully attractive system to go to a private system where they can make more money and it's far more regulated as far as their schedules, the things that they have to deal with. It really feels like things are being pushed, really given a good shove towards privatization. And as you mentioned, the $335 million in cuts and all the cuts that have always come. And you know, I'm trying to not be political, even though I'm obviously left and I lean left. Anybody that knows me or interacts with me is going to know that. But every time the Conservatives end up in charge, they end up cutting. You know, the last time was it Mike Harris? Mike Harris just absolutely gutted our health system and the nurses that were all fired. And it was just ridiculous losses to our healthcare system. We need to keep that running the way it is for services, but we need to do it in a far better and more efficient way to keep it. And your preventative measures make far more sense than, as you said, Dave Smith's version of, well, let's just open up some beds to deal with the aftermath. So let's talk about privatization and what we're seeing today and the cuts that have been made and how we can do better.
Sure. Well, look, you heard it from Brenna. The things that Brenna are describing, whether she slapped this label on it or not, are symptoms of a two-tier or partially privatized healthcare system. And it's kind of the worst kept secret in Ontario that there is sort of a hidden second tier that you can unlock with access. Look at long-term care. You know, there's kind of the three levels of long-term care in our province. There's the big fancy, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a month, all the bells and whistles long-term care. There's, you know, really fantastic nonprofit and yeah, some reputable for-profit long-term care providers. And then there's the vast majority of people who can't afford either any of those things, then have to go into these sort of bare bones for-profit institutions that are underfunded, that were, you know, bore the brunt of deaths in our province for COVID-19, for example, you know, no infection prevention and control, poor dietary things, a lack of funding for PSWs in these institutions, a lack of number of PSWs in these institutions, the patient to caregiver ratio is way too high. And so that if that isn't emblematic of there being two-tiered medicine in our province, I don't know what is. It exists. One of the things that really saddens me is, yeah, learning about the fact that there is a pay difference between community care nurses and institutional nurses. Community care nurses help keep people out of institutions. That is critically important work and a much cheaper way of doing healthcare. It's also a much more dignified way of doing healthcare. I speak to about 100 voters a week doing what I'm doing, seeking this nomination. And a lot of the folks I've spoken with in Peterborough are either aging or are at the stage where they're considering, what are my next steps? Can I stay in my home? And when I've spoken with them about a liberal commitment to investing in community care that helps them stay home, helps them you know, live their lives with dignity and saves the system money, they kind of slap their foreheads and go, goodness, isn't that a no-brainer? And it is. And so, first of all, the fact that there's such a wage discrepancy is really disappointing to me, because it is extremely clear that all nurses, every single nurse in our province, is doing life-saving, critically important work. And they should all be remunerated as such. And that absolutely includes community care nurses, really above and beyond. And I think that's one of the things I've been really encouraged to hear from some of, you know, the folks who are seeking other liberal nominations across the province as we enter into that stage of the political process. And also within Peterborough, that there's real enthusiasm for an investment in community care. Because again, that helps to sort of deprivatize things by providing people public care at home and public care in their own space and preventative care that prevents them from then having to make the choice of, should I sell my house and try and afford as long as I can, you know, better private healthcare, or do I need something that's subsidized and I want to provide for my family? No one should ever have to make that gut check when they're thinking about exploring what their next options are as they're aging. It's horrible. And when we're talking in specific about, pardon me, about mental health and mental health crises, there's absolutely as well a two-tiered system in our province. There are private psychotherapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists who provide mental health care to folks who can afford it. And for subsidized mental health care or public mental health care, there are months-long wait lists. One of the things that you spoke about in your introduction really spoke to me, which is the fact that we are about to enter into really an epidemic of burnout, and you said it in this question as well, of burnout, and mental health, you know, PTSD even, in our healthcare practitioners. And we are not prepared or equipped to handle that as an oncoming crisis. And I can speak to this, not just anecdotally, because this is actually work that I did in working for the hospital. The Ontario government does not fund healthcare practitioner mental health care specifically. If you are a healthcare practitioner and you want to receive mental health care, you have to go through the same system that everybody else does. Which is through waitlists and stuff like that. And there are no plans to change that coming out of COVID-19. I'm not saying that we should prioritize one sector's mental health over another sector's mental health and those professionals over another, you know, in normal circumstances, but these aren't normal circumstances. And there are other frontline workers like educators and education workers, grocery store workers, factory workers, you know, frontline and first responders across the entire province, all of whom are going to probably experience some degree of PTSD or mental health concern coming out of this pandemic, because our entire society has leaned on them and put weight on them for the last year and a half, and we're not done yet. And they're not able to take a breath and pause. And when they do, I bet we're going to see some real struggles. And again, I know this for a fact because where I came from, one of the tasks that I was given was to find $150,000 to fund a mental health program for staff, And I was tasked with going to private donors and really blessed to find some incredible support for that. But I was asked to go to private wealthy donors to fund mental health care and resiliency training for our first responders. That's privatized medicine, because we're having to go to, they're incredibly generous and people were willing to step up and do it. And I'm so inspired by that. But I'm also so disheartened about the fact that we couldn't turn to, as a hospital, we couldn't turn to the provincial government and say, we need $150,000 to prevent our doctors and nurses from collapsing on their feet. I don't think I need to say much more than that. It's infuriating. And look, I promise that if I am to move farther along in this process, that I will fight whole hog and wholeheartedly to make sure that all of our frontline workers receive the aftercare that they need for the trials and tribulations that we have put them through, really with a failure to deal with this thing properly throughout this entire pandemic. And the fact that they've had to go again and again and again into the fray, that we need to treat them as though they've done so, as though they're coming home from battle.
I think that's a great spot for us to end today. I want to do this again as we get further along, because we're going to see, I think we will definitely start seeing, when we start seeing the platform coming up from other people that are going to be running and seeing how they plan on addressing these issues. So thanks, Dane. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this with me. There's going to be a whole bunch more episodes of this show coming up very shortly as we're looking for sponsors and as we're looking for people to help prop us up and get it so we can continue having these conversations. But thank you very much for today. And I do wish you all the best and hope things go the way you want them to go in this.
Yeah, well, thank you, Chris, and kudos to you for taking this on as a project to be having these tough conversations with people like me who are seeking to represent the community. I think it helps people understand what my background is and where I'm coming from, and it also helps them understand and even just thinking about something maybe slightly differently than they have before. If my participation here has helped one person do that, then I'm really inspired and very pleased to have been here. And can I just, I'll do a shameless plug, say that, look, I am seeking the provincial Liberal nomination. And the number one thing that I need is support. I need support to get on the ballot. It is a movement that we're trying to build that is locally focused, ideas and issues driven, that elevates the issues that folks in Peterborough, Kawartha are facing to the provincial table. For the last 3.5 years, we haven't had that. We haven't had a real genuine voice that wasn't playing partisan politics at the provincial table. I really want to be a person who changes how we think about local issues and issues in our community when it comes to how someone, a provincial representative, deals with those things. I think I'm the right person to do that. I think I bring progressive and genuine ideas to the table. I really hope that I also bring willingness to listen, and I hope that's come across here, that I'm willing to, I've certainly got opinions and ideas, but I know that you do, and I'm speaking right to the listener and the watcher here, have ideas as well, and I want to hear them. And one of the ways that I can do that and be an effective representative for you is to have your support. It's simple and easy to do that. If you visit danebland.ca, that's danebland.ca, there's a form that's right there that you can sign up to help get me on the ballot. And to really be a part of a movement that helps to restore actual critical thinking and the actual presence of ideas at the provincial table. Wouldn't that be novel? If you can also learn more about my background, where I come from and where I stand on various other issues, not just mental health and healthcare, on that website as well.
Thanks, Dane. I really appreciate it. I want to wrap today on something that was talked about with Brenna. And it lends itself to the name of this show and what I've been trying to do over the episodes and the podcast episodes and the conversations I've been having. And that is, if you're struggling, don't diminish the struggle you're having. It's quite common and quite typical for people who have had traumatic experiences to look around and say, they've got it worse. I'm okay over here. Somebody else has it far worse than I do. And we need to stop doing that. people need to recognize when they're struggling and when they're in pain and when something traumatic has happened. Trauma for you is completely different than trauma for me and for him and for her, anybody that's gone through any kind of trauma. It's your own. We're talking about what we need to talk about, all of us. And we need to continue talking about those things. And that's why I am, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing with this. So we're talking. And for We're Talking, I'm Chris Potter.